Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 36, featuring my compelling conversation with Wes Moore, a best-selling author, an activist, and the CEO of the Robin Hood Foundation in New York City. Wes discusses the trajectories we take and how our decisions determine our ultimate destiny. I hope this episode leaves you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Throughout the Freedom Writers' journey, there were several crucial decisions, forks in the road that determined which path they would follow into their future. Sometimes those decisions were obvious. Other times, it was unclear which choices mattered and which ones were less consequential. But the Freedom Writers learned with time, as our guest Wes Moore so eloquently writes, each of those decisions could either be a stumble down the wrong path or a tentative step down the right one. It's impossible to know beforehand, but what matters most is being intentional. Being intentional about making the best decisions you can with whatever knowledge you have. Our esteemed guest today calls those moments crucial inflection points. Wes has made it his life's work to help all people, young and old, rich and poor, learn to recognize the power they have to make sound decisions that will lead to a better life and thus a better society. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or even a young person, may you be inspired by Wes Moore's honest and authentic story and his exquisite example of integrity and leadership. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Wes Moore. It is an honor to be seated beside Wes Moore, a best-selling author, a decorated Army combat veteran, a successful social entrepreneur, and the first CEO of Robin Hood, an innovative nonprofit dedicated to fighting poverty in New York City. Wes Moore's best-selling book, The Other Wes Moore, is a moving memoir about two young men from the same rough streets of Baltimore, but whose lives took dramatically different turns. So Wes, I want to start with that child born in Baltimore and facing tragedy at such a tender age of four. You learned about PTSD before you learned your ABCs in a classroom. So can you take us back to that tender age of four?
The only two memories that I have of my father was once where he was defending me before I thought I was about to get a beating from my mom for fighting my older sister. And my mother always had a bunch of rules in her house, but one of the big rules that she had in her house was that men do not put their hands on women. And it wasn't until I got older that I realized the reason that she was so insistent on that rule was because of her own abusive past. And so she would always say, I'll never tolerate it if I see it, and I especially will not tolerate it if I see it in my son. And so every time she would see me fighting my older sister, immediately she would grab me and she'd say, you do not put your hands on women, you don't put your hands on women. And then one time I was getting into a fight with my older sister and my mom saw it and she starts coming after me. I'm running in the other direction. And I go to our room, and the room that I was in, our bedroom was basically a closet that they turned into a bedroom after my baby sister was born. So inside this room, it was only like a small bed and a crib for my baby sister. And that was all that was there. But I'm running around the room trying to find a place to hide. And there's nowhere to hide in a room that size. And then when I started hearing footsteps coming, I thought it was my mom, and I thought I was about to get beat. And my father walked into the room, and he started explaining to me what I had done so wrong. You know, while my job is to protect my family and to never put my hands on them, while my job is to protect women and never put my hands on them. And he told me that I had to go apologize to my mother and to my sister. That was the first memory that I have of him. At that time, I was three, just turned four. And the thing I remember most was actually him taking me to go apologize to my mom because I held on to his hand and I was trying to copy the way that he walked. The only other memory I have of him was about 6 months after that when he died in front of me. And even when he died, I didn't fully understand what was going on. In fact, my mom told me a story which I didn't remember, but at his funeral, when I went up to go view the body, you know, at the front of the church, I looked at my Uncle Vin, who walked with my mom to go view the body, and I asked my father, who was laying in there, if he was going to come with us, because I must have thought he was sleeping or whatever. And it wasn't until I got older that I realized that he just wasn't coming back. as difficult as I thought I had it with that transition, the person who really had it toughest was my mom. Because, you know, now, first, unexpectedly and in a very unprepared way, she was now a widow with these three kids in a bad neighborhood who was going to raise these kids on her own. And she had no idea what this all meant. And my behavior just took a 90-degree turn.
Your earliest memories are really the themes and the metaphors for your life's work. Kids like yourself growing up in circumstances that are unsafe. And how is there reconciliation? How is there redemption? And in your father's case, teaching people about forgiveness.
Yes.
When you left Baltimore and came to New York, what was that like to be starting all over? Was that scary? Did you feel like a fish out of water?
I think I felt very alone at that time because, you know, I felt like I was coming into an environment that I didn't know. And that's the thing, especially during that time, the Bronx was just a crazy area. I mean, we're talking about in 1992, there were, you know, 2,300 homicides in New York City, which is such a crazy number when you think about it, right? I mean, now, you know, the number is 300 a year. I mean, we're talking 2,300, and it was all very concentrated. It was the crack era. It was an area where safety was a relative term, and you found yourself kind of navigating these worlds in really complex ways. And then my mom, she started noticing pretty early that things were not going well for me, that I was starting to get caught up in stuff in my neighborhood and all that kind of thing. And so she then decided that she was going to try to send me to another school. And she's like, maybe if I can send him to different schools, that'll help him out. She actually even saved up and sent me to an independent school that she had heard about. And it was a beautiful campus. And she's like, this will be what will help my son. Unbeknownst to her, I think that also became the place where I became the most lost. Because it was beautiful and it was great and the kids were learning Mandarin and all this kind of stuff, right? But it was also the place where I found myself really wearing the mask. And I very quickly became too poor for the kids at school who didn't understand why it took me an hour and a half to get to and from, you know, from my house. And I became now too rich for the kids in my neighborhood who now didn't understand why I thought it was too good to go to school with them. And so it was a place where I think I became most lost because you're almost trying to become this chameleon where you would do whatever it takes on either side in order to not even just gain respect, but just gain basic acceptance. And unfortunately, what it ended up meaning is you were never yourself.
Friedemeyer's talked about that a lot, that ability to be a social chameleon in an educational situation, which is ironic because your story is so entrenched in your academic success later on in life, going on to be a Rhodes Scholar, graduating with honors, going off to Oxford, but you were sent away to a military school, a reform school. So talk about what happened from Riverdale that would send you off to a reform school.
So it happened, I was 13 years old, and it's funny because in retrospect, I realized what an opportunity that I blew for myself, but at the same time, a place that I just was not emotionally ready for. I was really still dealing with a lot. And frankly, I was dealing with it in a way that the only answer that many people had for me was, well, let's just kind of move on past it. And I think one of the big lessons learned that I took from that is, you know, when we act like tragedy doesn't happen, then tragedy keeps happening over and over and over again. And oftentimes is then we are asking the kids to deal with it. We just didn't talk about stuff. You know, we just pretended like everything was normal and we move on. And actually, I've gotten very involved in this issue of mental health because the trauma that our kids are seeing, it's not normal and it's not okay. And for us as parents, guardians, educators, policymakers, to just simply ask a kid to just drive forward, it's not fair and it's not right because the trauma that they feel is real and it needs to be acknowledged, it needs to be helped, and it needs to be supported. And so I think oftentimes what happened was for me, my situation, and as I was coming up, you know, whether it was the trauma that was happening or happened within your home, whether it was the trauma that I was seeing in my neighborhood, whether it was the trauma that I was experiencing with my friends, none of it was acknowledged. And the expectation was, well, it's kind of like, you know, it's the three-year-old who's getting in trouble and they feel if they just cover their eyes, that just because they can't see, they think that no one can see them either. And so we're just kind of asked to cover our eyes.
What I love about you as a storyteller in so many different venues is we see through your eyes. And I think that because your memoir is this beautiful autobiography, it's also an anthropological dig into the psyche of other young boys. So for our listeners now, their homework assignment is to go out and get The Other Westmore. It was a national bestseller on the New York Times bestselling list. But what I love about the premise of The Other Westmore is the dichotomy of these two young men of Baltimore. So for a reader who's not familiar with your story, can you take us to this concept of how this book came to life?
Yeah, it was late 2000, so December of 2000. The Baltimore Sun, which is my hometown paper, had just written an article about how a local kid just received a Rhodes Scholarship. And they were talking about how, you know, both about the scholarship, and I was getting ready to be one of 32 American students to go study overseas and that
at
kind of
Oxford
thing.
Oxford University.
At Oxford University over in England, all expense paid. But they also talked about my background, and they talked about my childhood. And they talked about how at that time, just 8 years ago, I was in handcuffs. And they're talking about kind of like this transition that took place over a short period of time where you had this young man who was really having difficulty navigating. Now, at that time, 8 years later, was now getting ready to head off to England on a full scholarship as a Rhodes Scholar. And at the same time, they're writing a whole series of articles about four guys who walked into a jewelry store. Two of them had guns, two of them had mallets. And the ones with the guns were getting everybody on the ground, while the ones with the mallets were smashing out jewelry cases and taking out watches and rings and necklaces. The four guys met in the back of the store, and they had about $400,000 worth of jewelry, and one of them yelled, "Let's go." All four then ran out of the center of the store and ran outside to the adjacent parking lot. One of the people that was inside the store that day was an off-duty police officer who was moonlighting as a security guard. And he was a three-time recipient of Police Officer of the Year. He was a 13-year veteran of the Baltimore Police Force. He was also a father of five who just had triplets. And the reason he was working that day was because it was his day off from the police force, and he took on a second job as a security guard to make extra money for his family. And he got up and he drew his weapon and he ran outside to see if he could stop the guys from getting away. And when he ran outside, he started kneeling next to cars and vehicles to give himself cover. But he didn't realize that one of the vehicles that he was kneeling next to was one of the vehicles that the guys were in. And they rolled the window down and he was shot three times at point blank range, killed instantly. And there was a 12-day national manhunt for these four guys. Finally, after 12 days, all four guys were caught. And one of the people that the police were looking for that was eventually captured and tried and convicted and sentenced for the crime was a guy whose name was also Westmore. And the more I learned about him through these articles, the more I realized how much more we had in common than just our names. And so one day I just decided to write him a note. I wrote to him at Jessup Correctional Institution, where he was, you know, housed at that time. He had just begun his life sentence, life without parole. Him, his older brother, and two other guys who were there all got the same sentence. And I wasn't sure what to expect. I wasn't even sure if he'd write back or whatever. And about a month later, I get a letter back from Jessup Correctional Institution from Westmore. That one letter eventually turned to dozens of letters. Those dozens of letters turned to dozens of visits. I have now known Wes for well over 15 years. He's now in year 19 of his life sentence. But it was really through those conversations that eventually a bigger exploration happened, and where something I just wanted to share with people about just how thin that line is between our life and somebody else's life.
So for folks that didn't understand Baltimore at that time, you were able to get out and education was your salvation. For the other Westmore, what was his life like? Fatherless and surrounded with gangs and crack and projects?
He also grew up where it was just his mom raising him. I always say, you know, my mom had the benefit that she was able to kind of lean on her parents a little bit, my grandparents, and Wes never really had that same kind of support or luxury. Wes ended up moving a lot. In fact, in many ways, Wes actually moved to some nicer places and nicer areas. I think there are a couple big challenges that you know, Wes faced. One is the biggest influence in Wes's life was his older brother. And his older brother was really very much a do as I say, not as I do kind of guy. And his older brother had a pretty ferocious reputation in Baltimore. I mean, he was a serious dude, but he loved Wes. And he always would tell Wes, Wes, you're too smart for these streets. Like, I'm here because I need to be here. Like, you don't need to be here. You're a smart kid. And he was always trying to encourage Wes, you need to go to class. You need to do this. You need to go that. And Wes would always, you know, kind of do this whole, I don't believe in the do as I say, not as I do leadership style. And Wes admired his brother. I think another big thing, and probably some of the most heartbreaking moments for me writing the book, was once he got involved in the criminal justice system. This country can be unforgiving to people involved in the criminal justice system. Once you're involved, you don't need to work twice as hard. You need to work four times as hard.
And so disproportionately young men of color.
That's exactly right. I mean, we criminalize communities of color.
Yeah, absolutely.
We criminalize adolescents. You know, when you look at the data alone, you take drug crimes as one example where, you know, marijuana possession and marijuana usage is one example, is pretty evenly distributed amongst skin color in this country. But African Americans are four times more likely to be arrested and convicted for the same crime. So, I mean, we criminalize adolescents in this country, and oftentimes it's completely broken down by both racial and class lines. And then what happened oftentimes with Wes, even as, you know, I think for me, one of the most heartbreaking scenes, he finishes, you know, he's involved in the juvenile justice system and the adult prison system, but he decides, he's like, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of getting locked up. And so one of his friends tells him about this thing called the Job Corps. And he goes to the Job Corps, and the Job Corps is this program that was pulled together to help primarily students who were the most difficult to employ, give them a set of skills and help them put them on employment tracks. And Wes goes to Job Corps, he gets his GED, he finds out he's really good with his hands, finds out he really loves carpentry, and he becomes a really skilled carpenter inside of the Job Corps. And he comes out, and no one will hire him. And he finds he cannot get a job for a long period of time that pays him anything. And every time he starts to get a little bit of stability, once they find that he's a criminal record, they basically tell him, you know, there's no more room for you here. And so he goes back to the corners, and he goes back to the place that he knows. And that was kind of the prelude to what finally happened to him.
What I love as an educator that your book opened the door for so many was, especially on college campuses, they have what they call first read, where an entire college community chooses a single book, and either the entire freshman class reads it, the entire university class reads it. Your book is often chosen for an entire university to read, discuss. What does that feel like when you have made your way onto liberal arts college campuses, and suddenly people are dissecting your life story of these two young boys, the tableau of our American culture? You were the bridge to both.
It's amazing, and it's really humbling, because that wasn't the intention, right? I mean, like, I had no idea that I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to write a book that one day is going to be curriculum. That wasn't the intention at all. I mean, there's a couple of things that I've loved about kind of the freshman year experience. One is I love the idea of when classes are reading, you have people who are coming from all over the place, all over the state, all over the country, all over the world. And there's not really a common bond. You know, age for oftentimes for them isn't a common bond of who's a freshman, what location you're from is often common bond, background experience often common bond. So the school is basically saying, we want to make at least one common bond experience, and that is what we're asking our students to read as they're coming on board. The thing that I've also loved about that process is, you know, and I believe deeply, it's like, you know, like the book, don't like the book, I'm actually fine with either, but I want you to read it and debate it. I want you to discuss it. Whether the reader understands the streets in Baltimore that I'm talking about, whether they don't, whether they understand the dynamic of these two black kids or don't, whether they understand the true trauma of poverty in their own life or don't, I want to take the reader on a journey with these two kids.
You are a homing pigeon. You've traveled the world. You've had the most incredible resume, but you keep going home, and you keep going home to make it better.
Yeah.
You're raising your family in Baltimore.
Sure.
You're making the community stronger and better. So what would make someone having an opportunity to go to Oxford to be a Rhodes Scholar, what would make you want to join the military and be this celebrated combat veteran who served and sacrificed? You could have worked for any bank, any hedge fund, and you joined the military. Tell us about that part of your career?
You know, when I first joined the military, it was actually pretty simple. Was that they were going to pay for college. And the promise of the GI Bill and the promise of that they're going to pay for college actually made that decision pretty easy for me, because I knew a couple of things. One, I knew college was really expensive. And the other thing that I knew was that because of my military school experience, that I enjoyed leading. Right? I enjoyed leading cadets. And then I knew with the Army, I was like, I'm assuming I'll enjoy leading soldiers. And so that decision actually was a simple one for me in that way. That was also in 1998, so there wasn't a whole lot going on. We were a country in a time of peace. There was just the wars that came off in Bosnia, but that was really primarily an air war. Like, for soldiers like me, we really didn't have much of a role. And then obviously 3 years later, after 9/11, the whole context changed. And we immediately began this, what is now going on, essentially an 18-year-long war.
A lot of the Freedom Riders called urban warfare an undeclared war. So having been from an undeclared war, and then suddenly to be in a place like Afghanistan, yeah. Did you find similarities between both?
You did, and I think it's something that oftentimes people misinterpret, even when it comes to, you know, the fact that we have, I think the documented number now is about 25% of all veterans have some form of, you know, PTS or, you know, TBI, traumatic brain injuries, et cetera. And if you take the TBIs and you put those off to the side and you just focus on the ones who are dealing post-traumatic stress, the truth is that for many people, they were dealing with post-traumatic stress when they entered the military, where they were dealing with things for much of their life and the things that they had seen for much of their life. And so when they enter the military, and people can say, well, is it because of something that happened in Iraq or in my case, Afghanistan, whatever the case might be. And it's like, you know, we have to understand the context of the lives that for many people they were living and leading before they ever put a uniform on. So for me, the military became something that was powerful, and it was an important transition for me because, you know, again, partially I knew they'd pay for school, but then also it was a system I felt appreciated me.
I love that you did, though, with your writing, and then your ability to be a storyteller for a visual audience was to use the venue of CNN to have your incredible series about the military, and then also PBS to be an incredible storyteller about education. So let's talk about you going from being a writer to a storyteller with a different venue, where you're taking these really credible sources, be it PBS and CNN, and saying, I want to give faces and names to our military, and I want to give faces and names to our young men of color going off to college when it's difficult and scary and they don't have a roadmap. Once again, your story told through other eyes.
You know, I think for me, I was really moved by what are the things that I think actually get people to move on things. I love data and I love math and equations and all that kind of stuff. But I also know that statistics, they can provide context. But it's humanity that actually promotes action. And while statistics, which I love, can give a sense of where we are, I feel like humanity gives us a sense of where we should be going. I learned that process really through writing The Other Westmore about the power of narrative. You know, I remember having a conversation with my publisher once, and I said to him, I was like, what about if I turn this into a 10-step prescriptive guide? And he said to me, he's like, listen, Wes, that sounds really interesting and all, but I'm going to be honest with you. He said, no one wants to read a parenting book by a 30-year-old with no children. I was like, that's actually a pretty good point. And he said, tell us the stories. And I think it's because it's the fastest way to get people to care, right? I mean, someone could tell me a stat about any issue, and I could take it and understand it. And Aaron, I mean, you could tell me another stat 5 minutes from now that completely contradicts their stat. And the truth is, both of you might be right. I mean, that's stats, right? Stats is all about the inputs that you put in to focus on the outputs that you want people to pull away from it, right? That's statistics. But if you tell me something and you make it real for me, that I won't forget. The stories that you wrote about, the stories the students wrote about themselves, we never forgot those. And so that was the thing that I wanted people to understand, that, you know, when I'm talking about the plight and the challenges for young kids of color coming up, I don't want to just throw stats at you. I want you to understand these two young boys as they're trying to navigate a society and a community that oftentimes was intentionally neglected, and the worst part about it was that they knew it. You know, when we're talking about these two young men who are going off to higher education. I could tell you all the stats about what's happening to, you know, particularly for African-American men and boys as they're trying to navigate higher education. I could tell you every stat. But at the same time, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to actually take you on a journey of watching these two kids, both of whom were the first ones in their family to graduate from high school, who are now having to navigate higher education on their own. So when they go back and they talk about, I'm dealing with this or I'm dealing with that, their families have no context to give them advice, and how they are then feel like they're doing this process seemingly on their own.
In every work that you've done, you pay an ode to the mothers.
Yeah.
Starting with your mom, I know you have a very strong grandma as well, and going back to your dad, saying you go and apologize to your mom. So I love from the very beginning, you paid homage to women and your mother and now your wife. Can you talk about your love letter to all the women in your life and how you write about them, you celebrate them, and you showcase them in everything that you do?
You know, I think about the reality that the women in all of our lives, they are our backbones. You know, I think about even with, you know, sometimes when we talk about single moms, for example, like my mom, where people look at her like somehow she and her situation is our nation's burden. And they've been our nation's backbone. They've carried the weight. They've carried the water. They've been the ones where so many people have been mom and dad. They've been the ones who've had to, in many cases, not just work, but work multiple jobs in order to provide and support for the multiple responsibilities. And by the way, at the same time, they've been the ones who are doing the same work and not making the same pay. They've been the ones who have had to deal with everything from abuse and harassment and still had to keep a smile on their face and show up to work the next day. So I was intentional, like, you know, for example, when I think about the other Wes Moore, I dedicated the book to five women. You know, sometimes people find that interesting. They're like, it's just interesting that you dedicated a book about the journey into manhood of two boys and you dedicated it to five women. And it's because they were the ones who were carrying us most of the way, whether we understood it or realized it or not. And so the homage that I pay to my wife and my mom and my grandmom and my sisters is not because it feels like it's the right thing to do. It's because I know for each and every one of them, in many cases still to this day, I'm carried by them. And they do it with beautiful smiles on their faces. And I'll always appreciate and love them for it.
For our listeners who can't see me, I'm sobbing. I'm so moved by everything that you've done, and you continue to ascend. So now you're the CEO, the first CEO that the Robin Hood Foundation has ever had. Tell us about your mission. I know you are eradicating poverty in the city of New York.
Yeah.
So tell us about, how did this incredible foundation say that we need you to be the voice of what we do?
You know, it was interesting because when they first contacted me, at first I was a little confused because I said, like, I've never been in the foundation world before. I didn't come up in the foundation world. In fact, I told them, I said, I've actually historically been pretty critical of philanthropy. And in fact, the person who was the heading the search committee, was the board chair, has become a good friend. He said to me, he's like, yeah, we've seen your videos. He's like, we've done our diligence.
But you speak truth to power.
So that's it. And he said to me, he said, but the truth is that we've listened to what you've said and you're not wrong. Philanthropy does need to do more. Philanthropy does need to push a little bit harder. And it can't just be about the grants we give away, right? And I think one of the things I really appreciated about Robin Hood and how they've approached this work for so long, it's attacking poverty everywhere that it is, right? It's when people say, is this about education? Is this about housing? Is this about transportation? Is this about mental health? Is this about criminal justice? The answer for people living in poverty oftentimes is yes. It's all of it.
What's so unique about the Robin Hood is 100% of what people donate, 100% goes to your programs, that your board members have gotten together and said, for all of our employees, we'll take care of you. You go take care of the masses.
That's right. They take care of all of our operational expenses. So every dollar that goes into the organization can go into the fight. It goes to the work. We use data and metrics to make sure we're finding and funding and building the best organizations. But at the same time, we're very clear that we want the capital to really address the problem. None of us are satisfied with making poverty more tolerable. You know, I'm not interested in making poverty easier on people. I want to move people out. I want poverty to be history. I want poverty to be folklore. And to do that, it means just putting a sincere and a focused level of attention on addressing everything that is both putting people and keeping people in poverty as we speak.
You know, the Freedom Riders met John Lewis. He is our namesake, you know, as an original Freedom Rider. And he said that Dr. Martin Luther King nicknamed him the boy from Troy. But John Lewis knew that MLK saw something in him that was bigger than the boy from Troy. Mm. And I'm sitting with you, and I feel that 20 years in the future, you are bigger than that boy from Baltimore. Oh. What is your future hold? When I get to tell my friends and family that I was knee-to-knee with an icon, and I know you're so humble, you'll never call yourself that, but I see you so much bigger than a title, an author. You're limitless. What does your future hold? And if your future is limitless, could any kid in any city also have a future that's limitless?
You know, I remember once having a conversation, and actually this was a conversation with Oprah Winfrey about this once. My wife and I were with her, and my wife asked a question to her, and she said, do you think you can ask for too much? Like, do you think that, you know, you can ask God for too much? And her response was beautiful. Her response was, it's impossible. She said, because what God has in store for you is so much bigger than your imagination can even possibly comprehend. So it's impossible to think I'm asking for too much. So the honest answer is, when I think about what does the future hold for me, I honestly don't have an answer when it comes to a title or a position or anything along those lines. The answer that I can give that I know I want to hold true to is, I'm going to be useful. I'm going to continue to attack problems until they're no longer problems. I'm going to continue to fight for people until they don't need me to fight anymore. You know, some of the most influential people in all of our lives are people who don't have official titles. They aren't the people who, either by blood or by position or by court order, are the people who are in our lives. Sometimes the people we pay the most attention to are the ones who might have no official title. They might be people we've never even met before, right? But we watch them. We watch how they speak. We watch how they move. We watch how they act. And so I think the answer is, for all of us, every one of us are examples for young people who are going to come behind us. And I think that means we have to act accordingly. We have to act and speak and love accordingly, with an understanding or with a belief that somebody somewhere is watching you and modeling you. And that's why I think for many adults out here, the truth is we have to act better. And we need to force others to act better, to be accountable, and to know that their language and their words and their actions do matter. I remember once I was asked, are certain decisions more important than others? And I think about it for a second, because the truth is, yes, certain decisions are more important than others. But the truth is that we don't know which ones are which. We don't know which decisions are going to be the ones that are going to change our lives, and which decisions are the ones that, frankly, tomorrow you're going to forget you made that decision. So we have to treat every decision accordingly, and we have to treat every decision with the amount of weight that that decision potentially could carry. And since our kids are being asked to do that every single day, I think we, as the examples that they will watch and follow, then have to make sure that we are putting that same level of weight and gravity on the decisions that we make, because it is being modeled and followed.
You were the epitome of the humble servant. And in a time when it's trying, I mean, both you and I visit darkness. We go to juvenile halls, we go to prisons, we go to classrooms. I want to hold you up on every pedestal I can. I want to pass out your book to every reader I can. What does it mean to you to have young men say that you are a hero, say that they want to be just like you? What does that feel like, knowing that there are these incredibly beautiful men in our country, that you see something in them that maybe they don't see in themselves? You see possibility and promise and hope.
Bless you. I feel the same about you. You know, I think about so many of those places that we go and we visit. I think you said something really profound just now, and really powerful that I want to touch on. You know, how we are talking about places of darkness, right? And intentionally so. But I think what makes the young men and women who we see in those places so special is it takes something pretty bright, even when you're sitting in a place of darkness, to be so illuminating that you outshine everything around you. And so I put that to all the young people who we serve and we work with, the idea that you are already so great, truthfully, because you're here. Most people would have already given up. Most people already, life would have already taken you. Most people, this would have already been too much. And you're still here. Just that alone means you are special. Just that alone means you are chosen. Just that alone means you got something bigger waiting for you. And the only thing that we then in return ask is, as long as you are willing to fight, we are willing to fight alongside you. We're willing to make the battle a little bit easier for you. But to be so bright, to be so clear, to be so illuminating in a place that was intended to break you, and you can stand up and say, I'm still here, that just shows how special the young people we work with are.
I know that your grandfather was a man of the cloth. He was a religious man. I think you are divinely inspired. And I know that our listeners come from every ilk and religious background. But I think that the words that come out of you are your father, are your grandfather, are the young men in those dark corners. And I feel like I just want to say hallelujah or do spirit fingers. I feel like I'm in church right now, even though we're at the Robin Hood Foundation. So if we were, if I was sitting in a pew listening to you at a pulpit, what would your sermon be for the youth?
I think my sermon would be what my grandparents told me right before I went to Afghanistan. I deployed to Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne Division, and my grandparents gave me one of those small little green Bibles. And it was big enough that it could fit actually inside my flak vest. So every time I went on missions, I actually put this little Bible right inside my flak vest, right over my heart. And my grandfather, who actually passed away when I was in Afghanistan, wrote these words inside the front of the Bible. And by that time, he was already starting to get weaker. But he wrote the words where he just said, have faith, not fear. And those are the words that I think I would share. Have faith, not fear. If we lead and we live in faith, if we lead and we live in hope, if we lead and we live in love, we are going to end up in the place that God intended us to end up in. When we are making decisions based on fear, they will always be our worst. When we're making decisions based in fear, they will always be our least thought out. But if we're making decisions based in faith, that's the thing that's going to lead us where we need to get to. And so that's the prayer that I would give, is have faith, not fear.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Wes Moore, for his passion and his stirring calls to action. My dear listeners, no matter our position or circumstance, may each of us strive to be useful. May we lead with love and hope. And like Wes Moore, may we all live in faith instead of fear. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to support our podcast, I encourage you to leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you use. If you've already left us a review, thanks so much. And consider sharing the show with a friend, a family member, or anyone you think could benefit from these extraordinary guests. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruel. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.